Loyal Jones. Loyal Jones is a writer and speaker on Appalachian culture from Berea, Kentucky. He formerly directed the Berea College Appalachian Center, where he taught courses and ran workshops in Appalachian studies, started an annual festival of traditional music, and established the Appalachian Sound Archive of music, stories, and interviews. He has published a dozen books and many articles on Appalachian values, religion, humor, and music. Best known are his four books with singer-songwriter, playwright Billy Ed Wheeler: Laughter in Appalachia, Curing the Cross-Eyed Mule, Hometown Humor, and More Laughter in Appalachia. His latest book is Faith and Meaning in the Southern Uplands, which was published in 1999 by the University of Illinois Press. In 2002, the University Press of Kentucky published a new edition of Minstrel of the Appalachians, the story of Bascom Lamar Lunsford. It's very much my pleasure to welcome Loyal Jones to the podium.
I tell you what, I've never been in this at this much of a disadvantage in my life. Thanks, John. You know, I've dealt in humor a whole lot, and I've interviewed and talked with a lot of humorists, but damn fat, Rick Bragg isn't the most gifted of anybody I've ever heard. I want to start off with a little bit of verse here, but first I want to say that I know a lot more about corn than I did before I got this assignment. And I've looked at a lot of books, and I've come to, you know, a great appreciation of what the Indian culture did with corn, which was just some kind of coarse old grass that grew with a few kernels hanging to the tassel till it started. They started cultivating it, and through whatever means brought us what we know about as corn. And, of course, corn keeps developing in many ways. But I want to read this from Stephen Vincent Benet. I'm talking about corn as a way of life, as an anchor almost of a culture. But he wrote in his Western Star, "And those who came were resolved to be Englishmen. Gone to the world's end, but English every one. And they ate the white corn kernels parched in the sun, and they knew it not, but they would not be English again." Well, indeed, that parched corn and the seed corn that various Indian tribes gave to the early settlers changed. It saved their lives, first of all. It changed their lives, their habits, and their entire culture. And not just the English, perhaps, who thought perhaps that they were the most impervious to change, but all of those people who came, willingly or not, in to this country in the early days were changed. And corn was part of it. Corn became the most important crop in America. It fed families and their livestock and thus established and sustained a new way of life in a new land. By 1849, the South had 18 million acres planted to corn as compared to just 5 million acres of cotton. Corn's reproductive return is greater than for any other crop, with one grain producing anywhere from 500 to 4,000 kernels, according to how many ears you have on the stalk and so forth. Last year, we grew in the United States 9.5 billion bushels of corn at an average of 127.6 bushels per acre, and about 102 million tons of silage for animal feed. Products made from corn syrup and carbohydrates are used in numerous food products that we consume every day. In addition, there are more than 500 industrial uses of corn. It is in automobile paint, plastics, tires, textiles, library paste, gunpowder, baby powder, sandpaper, soap, surgical dressings, insecticides, shoe polish, embalming fluids, rubbing alcohol, deodorants, mattresses, varnish, brake fluid, adhesive tape, and fireworks. I'm speaking here of modern times, of course, but my purpose this morning is to talk about the life as I knew as a boy between 1935 and 1945 on farms in Cherokee and Clay counties in North Carolina in mountains that flowed up into the Great Smokies and the Blue Ridge. My father and I family were renters, and this was a fairly benevolent system and arrangement in the time and place that I'm talking about, contrasting with sharecropping in parts of the Deep South. Usually the farm was owned by a businessman who saw a farm as a good investment, maybe not to buy outright, but to buy on time. And he had to have a renter who could not only grow some crops that he would get part of and could thus pay off his bank loans and his taxes, but also would take care of the buildings and the house and the fence rows and all of the things that were part of the farm and gave it value. But of course, since we had our own workhorses, a wagon, turning and cultivating plows, a disc harrow, and a one-horse corn planter, we paid one-fourth of the corn crop. Some people who didn't have all these things paid as much as a half of the corn crop. But we also had all kinds of land for pasturage and hay and a woodlot for fuel for the winter and patches for corn, roast ears, and for beans and potatoes and that sort of thing. There were lots of sayings and folklore about living in the mountains and about hillside farming. We used to say we lived so far back that the sun set between our house and the road. And that the fields were so steep that we had to shoot corn into the ground from another hill with a shotgun. That we planted our potatoes in rows up and down the hill so that when you got to, wanted to gather them, you dug the lower hill out and just held a sack and caught the whole row, you know. That our livestock had shorter legs on one side than the other to traverse the hills. That we lived so far back, we had to use hoot owls for chickens. And and we planted those crook-neck, striped kushaws. I believe that's an Indian word, isn't it? Where's Meredith? Yeah, okay. Well, because a pumpkin might roll down out of one of those hills and kill somebody, see? But a kushaw, if it started to roll, it would just hook its crook neck around a corn stalk and stay put, you know, till it got ripe. And there were frequent stories about farmers and their horses falling out of the cornfield. We had some missionaries who came in, or some people who came in nearby county, and somebody over there regaled them with all this stuff, and they went back. They were from Dayton, and they were interviewed by an unsuspecting newspaper, which should warn you about those folks. And so he printed all of this in the Dayton newspaper as fact about farming practices in Appalachia. Since my time period involves the Great Depression, of course, there were also stories about hard times and hunger. And one night, this child woke his father up and said, "Papa, I believe there's a burglar in the house." And his father whispered back, "Just be real quiet. If he finds anything, we'll get up and take it away from him." And then there was this fellow who worked at the sawmill, and all he had to take for his lunch at noon was cornbread and turnips. Well, his wife was very helpful, and she baked and boiled and fried and might have even fricasseed a few of them, you see. And so they'd have a little variety, but he just got so tired of cornbread and turnips, he swore that he's going to sneak off a little early. They all put their lunches or dinners, they would have called it, up there on the plank. And so he said he's going to slip off and get the heaviest one he could find and run off in the woods and eat it before the rest of them came in for dinner. Well, he did. He hefted them all and got the heaviest one and went off in the woods and opened it and found 7 walnuts and a claw hammer. The late Grandpa Jones, no kin to me, but a friend, claimed that his family didn't have money to buy clothes for him when he was growing up. But when he got to be 15, they bought him a hat and let him look out the window. Well, one of the things I've noticed about life in Appalachia, and certainly the South, is that humor is a way of life as much as corn was that I'm talking about today. Corn was the most important food crop we had, but anyone eating corn, just a corn diet, would come down with that awful depression disease, pellagra, which caused diarrhea, loss of appetite, ulcers of the tongue and skin, depression, sluggishness. A lot of you don't remember this, but there were a lot of people who had this during the depression, and even delirium. The reason corn doesn't have vitamin B, but beans do, niacin, and as Bill Biss knows this very well. And the Appalachians had numerous varieties of beans, and Bill's growing a lot of these beans. He's over 100 now. How many got, Bill? 200. I'll go. He's gaining on it. Yeah, it's my grandma's beans. Yeah, that had come down through my mother, and my 92-year-old sister gave me those year before last. I didn't even know she had that. But anyhow, with beans, of course, you had a pretty well-balanced diet, as did the Indian. So I pause, you know, to pay homage to beans and Bill Best here. Zebulon Vance, the Civil War governor of North Carolina and later senator, was as good a politician as there was, and he knew the importance of beans and used them in his political campaigns. He'd have his wife tie up a little budget of beans in a paper or a piece of cloth, and as he went through campaigning, he'd stop at a house and say to the lady of the house, my wife here, you know, said my wife wanted you to have some of her lazy wife beans, and she wondered if you'd give her a few of your goose crawl beans, you know. And so the woman would go tie up some goose crawl beans. And he'd go, of course, to the next house and say, my wife wanted you to have some of her goose crawl beans, and et cetera, you know, which is pretty good. I can't resist telling one other good story about Zeb Vance. When he was senator, he's down, I think he was down on the coast, and he made a speech, and this rather full-bosomed woman came running up and said, I'm going to take you to task, Senator. I'm going to give you tit for tat. And, of course, Zeb said with alacrity, tat. Well, he was a good Appalachian born in Madison County. You can find out more about him in Sharon McCrum's The Ghostwriters, her latest novel. She has fictionalized him somewhat, and Thomas Wolfe did also in his Hills Beyond. Zeb was one of the great characters of the South. We had quite a bit of semi-level land on both of the farms that we lived on, so that plowing, planting, cultivating, and harvesting was not all that much of a problem. However, some farms were so tilted that they had to be plowed, that is, the land turned over, with a hillside turning plant, which you flatlanders probably never heard of, which was one that had a wing that you could throw from one side to the other. All moldboard plows, you know, have a wing that turned the soil over. Well, this had a wing that you could flip over from one side to the other, so you always plowed back and forth across the hill, turning the soil over that way. The only disadvantage to this, if you lived there for about 100 years, you were moving all your topsoil down about a foot every year. So it wound up at the bottom of the hill. But anyhow, that's how they did it. And Bascom Lunsford used to do a humorous speech. He called a stump speech in the 10th District, which he recorded, I think, for Columbia about 1930. And it included this fine metaphor. My platform is like one of your hillside plows. When I gets to one end, I just turn the wing over and plow back t'other way. I like that. On steep hillside farms, corn had to be planted by hand or with a stabber or a jobber. Joe Dabney knows about this. That is a homemade planter with a corn hopper mounted on one of two hinged boards with handles at the top and pointed wood or metal blades at the bottom that could be stabbed into the ground. And then you pull these two things apart, and it dropped corn down into the hill. On steep, on most of these hills, you put about four grains, because you had a saying there that said, one for the blackbird, one for the crow, one for the cutworm, and one to grow. And everybody who's farmed knows how it is in planting and getting a stand, as we call it. One mountain response to how are you was to the hill, which meant you were doing better than expected. Cultivation on steep hillsides had to be done with a mule or a horse, and usually a double-foot plow, and with a hoe, of course. On the hillside farms, sleds were used instead of wagons to gather the corn. My dad was a pretty good farmer. He always planted a cover crop of rye or wheat or crimson clover and let it get quite a growth in the spring and then turn it under, which, of course, enriched the soil and put humus in it, so forth. We had a neighbor on a nearby farm that was just completely worked out. He got about 5 or 10 bushels to the acre, I guess. And he always bemoaned and regretted that crimson clover going under because he thought it would make such fine hay. He didn't use fertilizer either because he thought it was a waste of time or money. Money. My father did always use fertilizer. We plowed the ground with a moldboard turning plow, disc and drag hired it, and then laid off rows with a single foot or a bull tongue plow. We planted corn when the oak leaves were the size of squirrel's ears, or when the dogwood was in bloom. My father gave some attention to the signs of the zodiac and phases of the moon when planting, using the farmer's almanac, which everybody had, or those calendars that the millers or grocery store people had that told you this information. And in general, the below-ground crops like potatoes were planted on the dark of the moon, and the above-ground crops like corn were planted when the moon was waxing toward full. I am indebted to Joe Dabney for refreshing my memory from his wonderful book about some of these things. My older brothers had all fled the cotton fields, the corn fields to the cotton mills of the Piedmont at the time I speak, although my two sisters were still at home during the period I speak of. And of course, they had to do their duty in the cornfields as well. And they wore these large hats and stockings on their arms so they wouldn't get sunburned, because in those days, brown skin or red skin denoted that you were a country person. My job was to feed the seed corn and the fertilizer into the corn planter, which my father operated with a single horse. I would mix in, he'd have me mix in pumpkin seed with the fertilizer, which were then deposited randomly over the fields, and we grew pumpkins in with him. One year we had 14 wagon loads of pumpkins, which the hogs and cattle and horses, you had to bust them up for them, and we ate and had a few pies out of. But, of course, we kept two mares in those days, and we raised foals each year. And my happiest memory is dawdling in the fields while my father was planting the corn and playing with those foals. At first, the foal, this was sort of the first task, you see, for these young foals. And they would follow their mother back and forth and back and forth until they were so tired they would drop. And then finally figure out that she would always come back from the far end of the field. And after they learned that, they became wonderful companions. And I have many happy memories of these wonderful foals that we raised and sold or else used as workhorses when their mamas became too old. In those days, we grew hickory cane corn, and then later, I remember, we just called it prolific corn, meaning it had more than one ear to the stalk. After the corn was up a few inches, we began the long task of cultivation. Our two-horse riding cultivator was a wonderful tool, and when I was old enough to operate it, and they were well-trained, and you had these two stirrups that you could guide the wheels back and forth if you were getting too close, but these were wonderful workhorses, and I found I could read a book while going down the line until my father caught me at it. The hoe was the most used tool in our cornfields because the weeds were virulent and relentless. And also, we had to have to properly thin the corn and then replant where it hadn't come up. For children, the most dismal phrase in the English language was hoe corn. And of course, the most anticipated and happy one was time to lay the corn by, because that meant you no longer needed to cultivate it. It's up so it could outgrow the weeds and you'd do more harm than good by cultivating it. And after you laid it by, you sort of had a few days you could go fishing or go do what you want to. But not for long, of course. The beans and the apples were coming in and the fence rows needed attention. My mother and father never rested for long, especially my mother, who ran from one task to another, from getting up time to bedtime. When the corn had reached maturity and the blades were turned red or brown, we cut tops, that is, cut off the part above the ear and tied them into bundles and either hauled them to the barn for livestock fodder or stacked them in the field around a pole in such a way they were waterproof. Nearby our corn patches, we cut the green but mature corn off at the ground and then shocked it so that it continued drying out. It was also protected from the weather. When the corn was dry and hard, we pulled it by hand and threw it into the wagon as the horses ambled along by themselves and as we picked two rows at a time, with every fourth wagon load going into a separate crib for the owner of the farm. We also planted rows of sweet corn for roast ears, and after the corn was up a ways, we'd plant some variety of cornfield beans that produced bushels that were canned or dried, as Bill Best has already told you about last year. We ate corn and beans every day when they were in season, and my mother and sisters canned great quantities. We also pickled corn and beans by putting them in a crock and adding salt and water with a plate on top to hold them down, just as you'd make kraut, and it worked and made its own vinegar. Then you had to can it later, but pickled corn and pickled beans are a special delicacy. I don't hear about much anymore. I don't know whether people are still doing that in great numbers or not, but we loved pickled corn and beans. We planted several rows of popcorn and popped it in the fireplace with melted butter, of course, to pour over it. My mother and sisters also made popcorn balls using sorghum to hold it together, and then we strung strings of popcorn for Christmas decoration, if we had a tree or the mantle or whatnot, and then put them out after New Year's for a few people who were still celebrating old Christmas. They would keep it there till after January the 6th, which was old Christmas at that time. In the older days, the field corn would be pulled piled up in the barnyard, and there'd be a corn chucking with food, music, dancing, and everything, and probably some whiskey and wine out in the shadows. There'd be red ears within the corn, and anybody finding a red ear could kiss the person of his and her choice. But this custom had died out by my time, partly because we were blue-nosed Baptists who rejected strong drink and anything else that looked like it might inspire dancing. You know, I kind of envy Rick and his family in a way. T. Bubba Bechtol said that he belonged to a sect of Baptists that didn't believe in premarital sex because they're afraid it might lead to dancing. Well, if we'd shuck the field corn, we'd shuck the corn and haul it to the crib or barn and then put the stalks and the, fodder over into the pasture for the cows and the horses to eat on during the long winter days, and they'd eat everything, the shucks and the fodder, and of course the stalks as well, because there are a lot of sugars and nutrients in the stalk itself. We shucked the corn in the crib as we needed it and fed the shucks to the livestock. The hogs and the horses ate the corn from the cob, but for the cows, we took the corn to the hammer mill, usually shucks, cob, and all. And it was all hammered up into a coarse feed, and we also bought sacks of cottonseed meal to add to this for additional protein, because corn has only about 11% protein. Sometimes we had the shell corn ground coarsely for the cattle and also for the chickens. Although the chickens could eat shell corn if they had a source of gravel to grind it in their craws. Corn as grain and fodder was the main diet of the horses, corn, hogs, chickens, and ducks, and they supplemented our own diet with milk, butter, eggs, and meat. Corn left in the field, pilfered from the crib, or in the animal manure, supplemented the diets of the wildlife around us, including the mice and the rats and the rabbits and the squirrels and the groundhogs and almost everything else. A few deer, because in the Depression, most of them were killed out. There was an old joke that is against the law to shoot up in the air before 9 o'clock in the morning in September and October, because somebody might be up there in a cinnamon tree trying to get his breakfast, we had all sorts of things like geese and quail and doves and other birds, and I'm going to confess in this age of animal rights that two of those nice Canadian geese who used to frequent our cornfields on their migratory routes didn't make it all the way to wherever they were going. One of my tasks was to shuck and shell enough corn for a turn of meal. We had a large sheller with a long crank and a fly wheel, and you get it going, then you can throw in the corn ears one after another. It was an efficient and wonderful instrument. I have no idea where my father got it. I usually took a bushel of corn to mill. I'd throw the old Buena Vista saddle on Lucy, put the corn on the pommel in front of me, and ride to the mill. The other mare, Princess, no doubt a cavalry reject because she had a U.S. brand on her hip, and I'll tell you why she was rejected. She was gentle as a lamb, as a plow horse and everything, or out in the pastures, wonderful mare, but she didn't much like for you to ride her, but she wasn't always dependable about that. She'd let you ride her for a while, and then she'd go into these wild sunfish fence row bucking, and off I'd go always. This miller would take about a tenth, I believe it was, in his toll, and there's a lot of folklore about the miller and his toll, like the butcher with his thumb, you know, on the scale. Bascom Lunsford used to sing a ballad called The Dishonest Miller. The miller's at death's door, and he calls in his three sons to see which one is the most likely one to take over his mill. The oldest one is named Heck, and he says out of a bushel he'll take a peck. It's Does everybody know what a peck is these days? It's a quarter of a bushel. You know, we had peck measures and half bushel measures and bushel measures on the farm. The next son, Alf, says that out of a bushel he'll take half. And the youngest, Jack, says that he'll steal the corn and swear to the sack. So naturally, he gets the mill. Sometimes we'd have the corn ground coarsely for those grits that Rick was talking about. I don't agree with him altogether. I like that cereal taste, although I like the butter and the salt and the pepper in it as well. But we mainly ate them, it's plural, you know, with sugar and milk like a hot cereal. I'll have to ask him what he'd think of that sometime maybe. We ate cornbread twice a day with biscuits for breakfast, although some poor people ate cornbread three times a day. My mother also baked cornbread for the dogs to supplement the table scraps. And when my father put fish baskets in the river, my mother baked unleavened cornbread with onions in it to attract the catfish. And we caught many a pound of catfish that way. When we killed hogs and rendered lard, my mother made crackling bread. Cracklings, of course, the what's left when you render most of the fat out for lard. And that made for a tasty and greasy and calorie-laden bread. It's always another kind of bread was gritty bread made from hardening green corn grated off as a soupy meal to which you would add corn, a little cornmeal or flour if you want to, and baking soda, and of course bacon fat, and you'd bake that nice and fat. I haven't had any in 30 years, I think. At least once a year, my mother made up a batch of hominy, a peck or half bushel. She'd soak the kernels in a solution of red devil lye. In the old days, of course, they would have leached this out of the wood ashes that you'd save from your fireplace or cook stove. And after the hulls were gone, after they were soaked, she'd wash this then in water and then cook it over outside using a pot out there that she had out there. And then we'd eat hominy, usually seasoned with butter or bacon fat and sometimes fried until we couldn't stand the sight of it. And then she'd can the rest of it for another time. Hardly anyone, including Joe Dabney, writes about corn without mentioning the liquid variety. As I said, we were blue-nosed Baptists, and we never made any liquor. Although my father always went out and obtained a pint of moonshine in the fall, and then he'd pour honey in it or put rock candy in it, and that was our cough medicine, although we had to use a tablespoon with it. That's the Baptist way. I did have two experiences with the product. There was a rental house about 200 yards from our house, and an old couple named Haas, H-A-A-S, lived there. I was neighborly and would visit them often, but Mrs. Haas always kept me out on the front porch. In fact, she gave me... where did I put this? She gave me this... little ceramic Noah's Ark 65 years ago, I guess. And I've had it ever since. It got broken, and thanks for epoxy. It's back together again and still has a few pennies. I don't know whether they date to that or not. But that was to keep me out of the house. Because my father told me later that Mr. Haas, who was an inventive fella, had made a still for his cook stove. And he was making a little whiskey in there to get by in the Great Depression. You know, the revenuers were always out looking for smoke, but they didn't think too much of somebody having smoke coming out of their kitchen because people were always canning and cooking and doing all those things. But anyhow, that is a memory that's very vivid to me. And I don't know what happened to them. They moved away and I never heard from them again. But they were, as Rick talked about, kind and gentle people to me anyhow, except for not being hospitable about going in the house. But they had found a way to get by in that time. Then at the other house, there was a storehouse been at the other farm, remodeled and rented out, and it had a chicken house go with it. Almost everybody had a chicken house in those days. And one day I saw this old big long car go driving up the little trail to the chicken house. So I ran through the woods. I was always alert and curious. And there was Tally Troll. And I knew about him, and he was known as a bootlegger and moonshiner. And there he stood with his blue serge suit and fedora hat pulled down with a vest and tie, you know. And to me, he looked as dangerous as old Scratch himself. And they started carrying these boxes and putting them into the chicken house. And after they left, I went and looked, and they were, each box was filled with about four half-gallon jars, fruit jars of moonshine. Well, I was sort of a junior soldier of the Lord, and I thought it'd be good if if I borrowed some of my mother's Epsom salts. That used to be a common purgative of the time. But I chickened out, and it wasn't long before another car came and carried off that liquor, you know. So that's my experience with moonshine. Other uses of corn had to do with play. We boys had corn cob fights. Any dry cob could hurt, but a well-soaked one could raise a knot on your head. You could hang your hat on and would addle you, you know. We also made fiddles, cows, horses, and primitive dolls and dollhouses and dollhouse furniture out of the corn stalks. There are a lot of inventive ways, you know, to put those things together. Dried corn silks pasted with pumpkin juice made a wonderful handlebar mustache. Some girls made dolls out of corn shucks, and other people made usable horse collars out of braided corn shucks and also twisted them into cords for chair bottoms. And Berea College, up until recent years, had these early American chairs with corn shuck bottoms in an attractive pattern. I don't think anybody knows how to do those anymore around Berea. Corn was indeed a way of life because we spent so much time with it, preparing the land, growing it, harvesting it, turning it into feed on our own food. It sustained us and all the farm animals, which supplied the power for farming, or the eggs, milk, butter, and meat that supplemented our diets. It was mainly a subsistence way of life, as I remember it, with a few bushels of corn to sell, a few chickens, eggs, calves, maybe several pigs. I got through high school mainly with one old brood sow who delivered up 3 litters a year at $10 a piece, was a lot of money in those days. And, of course, you had to have some cash to buy new shoes and dresses and overalls and the necessities of salt, sugar, and baking powder. You could get by with those. For many, it was a hard, discouraging, and defeating existence. But as I remember, in our case, it was a way of life that was rich in values, family closeness, hard work, responsibility to one another, reliance on spiritual hope beyond the cornfield, humility and modesty, confidence in making do with what you had, and I think a biblical restraint in thought and deed and against avarice and greed. And values, some of these, I think, have eroded in society as we have changed into an electronic society, especially that humility and modesty as people now have to sell themselves as a product, particularly the politicians. It was a time, too, of good eating and hard work that canceled out the calories. Recently, I was reading Willie Nelson's Fact of Life and Other Dirty Jokes. I don't know whether that's his only book or not. It fortuitously came in to possession of a copy, and as I was reading through it, Willie claims that Elvis's last words were, "Corn? I don't remember corn." Well, I really don't know whether these were Elvis's last words or not. I tried to call Bobby Ann Mason, who did a book recently on Elvis, but she had an unlisted number, and I never did get her number. But I'll tell you this, if I just wish all those people quit looking for him, because if he don't even remember corn, he ain't going to be no good to nobody.
We've got a few moments for questions. Who wants the mic? Y'all getting sleepy?
Covered it very well, didn't I?
Any questions?
I thought you followed Rick Bragg very well.
Oh, thank you.
Enjoyed your speech.
That's quite a compliment. Thank you.
I also want to know what your cane is made out of.
I'm sorry?
The cane.
This is rhododendron cane from, I think, Avery County, North Carolina. Anybody in here remember Lula Bell and Scotty, who were on WLS for so many years? Well, Scotty died, you know, and Lula Bell married Ernie, and I invited Lula Bell to come and sing it. Maria and Ernie came along, and he is a lawyer, and therefore he had some coins of the realm. And he brought a bunch of these things he bought off of an old man down there and gave me one of these. And I had a hip replacement, as did Bill Ferris down there, and we're both on canes. And it's been very helpful, and I'm grateful for the cane. A what? Oh, yeah. Well, by the way, I forgot about corn cobs. You know, did anybody, how many of you used corn cobs to stopper your kerosene, can? You know, cobs were very useful in many ways, and I was going to, but knowing the gentility of this group, I decided not to enter into that. Yeah, that was one back there.
You always see that ornamental, colorful corn around Halloween and Thanksgiving with the red and brown kernels. I'm wondering whether that is ever edible, if it's only just for looking at.
No, I think it's quite edible. It would make a sort of funny-looking meal, I guess. By the way, I grew up with people who wanted only white corn for meal. That yaller corn was for the livestock. People like the cornbread white. But I think you could eat that. Certainly the Indians did, right? It's generally called Indian corn. Sure it is. Yeah. I stand corrected. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Loyal, I have a quote for you to match Elvis's from William Faulkner. Someone asked him why he loved bourbon so much. He said, "There's a lot of nourishment in an acre of corn."
That's great. That's good. I hadn't heard that.
One last question or comment. Going once, going twice,
gone. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.